Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Natural History Museum of Utah's 2016 lecture series. And this is actually our 10th year hosting this series. I'm Sarah George. I'm the executive director of the museum, and I'm thrilled to see you all here tonight. I also want to welcome our radio audience listening to us on KCPW 88.3 and 105.5 FM. This year in our series, we're unraveling the unknown and meeting 21st century explorers who are destined to expand our understanding of the world. We kicked off the series a few weeks ago with astronauts Mark and Scott Kelly. I hope you saw Scott in his gorilla suit on the news in the last couple days. They discussed with us exploring the outer reaches of space. And in the coming weeks, we're going to explore the depths of the oceans and the mysteries of tropical forests around the globe. I'm thrilled to continue the series this evening with Dr. Phyllis Coley, and you'll meet her in just a moment. First, I want to thank a number of sponsors and partners who make it possible for the museum to produce a series like this each year. We're particularly grateful to our founding underwriter, the R. Harold Burton Foundation, and our underwriter, the Cultural Vision Fund. They have given us tremendous and ongoing support for this series. We'd also like to thank our gold sponsor, Rio Tinto Kennecott, our silver sponsors, the Clark Foundation, the Kent C. and Martha H. DeFiore Family Foundation, and Myriad Genetics. I'd also like to acknowledge our media partner, of course, KCPW. And then I have to say how much we appreciate the voters of Salt Lake County. Last year, 2014, they approved the Zoo Arts and Parks Fund, and by doing so have provided incredible support for cultural organizations all across Salt Lake County. So thank you all. And then I want to extend a special thanks to Kingsbury Hall, to Liberty Heights Fresh, to the Viridian Center, and to our hosts tonight, the City Library, for allowing us to have this lecture in this beautiful auditorium. So join me in thanking all of our sponsors. So our speaker this evening is Dr. Phyllis Coley, and she will be introduced by her former doctoral student, Dr. Sylvia Torti, who is Dean of the Honors College at the University of Utah. Sylvia is a biologist focusing on questions of tropical forest diversity in Africa and Central America, and she's also an award-winning novelist exploring the resonances between scientists and the subjects they study. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Sylvia Torti.
Good evening, and thank you, Sarah, and all of the excellent staff at the Utah Museum of Natural History for this highly engaging seminar series, and for the opportunity to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Phyllis Coley, Distinguished Professor of Biology in the Biology Department of the University of Utah, and as Sarah mentioned, my PhD advisor. When I started graduate school, I was like most people. If I thought about tropical biology at all, I imagined white sandy beaches and rainforest-covered volcanoes, gorgeous birds, maybe a cute monkey, and some sea turtles. Well, during our first field trip together to the Darién of Panama, the eastern remote part of Panama, Lissy helped to dispel all of that. Here are some of the images I remember from that trip. Landing on a grass airfield, a rickety hotel that leaned onto the neighboring bar, which played nonstop loud music night and day. Beds that were originally hospital cots from the old hoof and mouth clinic. Amazing. With humidity at 98%, I remember slipping around on the plastic sheets. The hotel didn't have regular sheets, and apparently Lissy and Tom knew this. They had their own that they'd brought, but they hadn't thought to tell me. So I didn't sleep all night, and in the morning when I got up and went into the toilet, there was a large dead rat floating in the toilet bowl. I hardly knew Lissy and her husband and collaborator, Tom, and I couldn't have predicted their behavior when we arrived at the forest that morning. Lissy, with the body and energy of a 25-year-old, jumped out of the boat, followed by an equally fit Tom, who grabbed a vine and swung himself onto the shore like Tarzan. No kidding. They scrambled up this muddy bank, and they began to identify plant species. To me, the leaves were all the same, indistinguishable, the shade of green, dark, tough, rubbery, with a smooth, waxy coat. During the next 2 weeks, early morning to late at night, because I tell you, these two really never stop, I got to see firsthand two of the best tropical biologists working. Over the past 30 years, their complementary ways of looking at the world has triggered many novel ideas, and tonight you'll hear about some of their work. My most enduring lesson, though, of the weeks we spent wading thigh-deep through black water and eating little more than mangoes and tough chicken was Lissy's insatiable curiosity, the ease with which she moved through the forest, and her keen questions about ecology and evolution. Lissy inspired me and my dissertation work. She not only greatly influenced my life, but she's inspired a whole generation of ecologists. Every single one of her field assistants has gone on to graduate work, and her work has motivated the careers of 150 students. Lissy's internationally known for her scientific contributions on how tropical trees defend themselves against their nemeses, which are tiny insect herbivores. She's published over 100 papers, and two of her publications rank number 1 and 3 as the most highly cited papers in the field. She's won too many awards for me to start listing tonight. About a decade ago, she and Tom parlayed their basic science into an applied project linking the discovery of new pharmaceuticals with education and conservation. Not only were they successful in receiving a multi-million dollar award, but their bioprospecting project was heralded as the model for how drug discovery should be done in tropical forests. Lissy and Tom are known throughout the tropics. You go to Panama, Costa Rica, Peru, Brazil, people talk about them. These days, though, they're more often found in Ecuador and Guyana. It would seem that every time a field station upgrades to better internet service, Lissy finds a reason to go to another more remote site. We're on to you, Lissy. Tonight, I would like to thank Lissy for her contributions, not just to me and my life, but to science and education. And I am so excited for you all to hear about the fascinating world of plant tropical biology in which she lives. Lissy Coley.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. And I have to admit, it was a really big rat. I'm not sure the rest of it is true. Whoops. We're jumping way ahead here. So I'd also like to thank Sarah George for inviting me to talk in this series. And last but not least, my husband, Tom, who Sylvia gave a great introduction for, we're joined at the hip. So all the work I'm going to talk about today was done with him as well. So I hope some of you were fortunate enough to see that fabulous talk by Mark Kelly, the astronaut. He had a really humorful and moving picture of space and said he never got tired of gazing at Earth. And so here's another view from space of Earth at night, and you can see all the lights associated with the human settlements. And I spent my entire life actually doing research in the areas you can't see. The dark areas of South America, Africa, and Southeast Asia, the humid tropics. And today I'm going to try and burrow into that part of the Earth, the tropical rainforests that blanket the equatorial regions of the world, what most people refer to as jungle. And I've spent my entire academic career trying to unpeel the sort of amazing and complex interactions among the species that live in these forests. And today I hope to give you a glimpse of some of the most important of these interactions. For example, 50% of the organisms on Earth are either plants or the animals that eat them. And we refer to these animals as herbivores. And I've just put up some examples here of insect and mammalian herbivores. They're completely vegetarians. Thus, the biggest battle on Earth is that between plants and the herbivores that are trying to eat them. And this battle has had a huge impact on the world as we know it. And mediating the astronaut theme, mediating this battle is the amazing universe of chemical compounds hiding within the leaves themselves. But this vast chemical space is largely unexplored. So today I'm going to try and show you the links between this chemical universe and the enormous biodiversity of tropical rainforest. So here's the roadmap. First, I'm going to try and convince you that plants are interesting. In fact, perhaps more interesting than the big fuzzy mammals that usually draw our attention. Then I'm going to try and touch on some of Tom's and my current scientific questions. And I'll also explain how we collect the data and show you some of the risks and joys of doing field biology. And finally, I'll mention how we've applied our basic science about plants and herbivores to helping humans and forests in a more practical way. So what's the first thing you see, as Sylvia said, when you go into the forest? Leaves, leaves, and more leaves. And they all look alike. So it must be a paradise, then, for herbivores. And I showed you before a sloth and a tapir, but the vast majority of herbivores are actually insects. And they're fascinating. This one is a grasshopper. It's not from outer space. It's from the Amazon. And it actually drew a lot of my blood before this picture. This one is the caterpillar of the blue morpho species that's on the posters of Come Visit Costa Rica. This is a katydid that is actually a marvelous mimic of a dead leaf, complete with herbivore damage and disease spots. And this caterpillar looks very much like a twig, as does that caterpillar. So if you look more closely, the forest is full of these just remarkable insect herbivores. So a tropical forest, then, with all those leaves should be like a paradise for herbivores, right? You know, like living in a giant salad bowl. Wrong. There's almost nothing edible out there. Plants are really well defended. And I think most people think of plants as sort of helpless vegetables sitting around waiting to be eaten. But they're not helpless. In fact, they've evolved a battery of really stunning defenses, and I just want to give you a flavor for some of them. So as I alluded to before, there's this universe of toxic compounds hidden inside leaves. And in fact, our work has shown that 50% of the weight of a leaf is these toxic compounds. You know, 50%, a leaf has a job to do, photosynthesis, and yet half of the leaf is devoted to poisoning herbivores. So given that leaves invest half their resources in defenses against herbivores, this suggests that the battle must be pretty important. So furthermore, a single leaf is loaded with dozens, sometimes hundreds of different kinds of compounds. And this compound is new to science. And in other words, it was never before discovered by scientists until Susie, pictured here, an undergraduate in the lab, found it. And as exciting as it was for Susie, it's not that unusual to find new compounds. It actually has a scientific name now, but we still refer to it as Susie's compound. So despite all the sort of remarkable advances by pharmaceutical and chemical biologists, nature is still the best place to find compounds. And so to illustrate what an inventive chemist nature is, here are data on the structural complexity of compounds. And so each dot here is a different compound. So if they're clumped, as they are here, in compounds invented by lab chemists, that means they're all structurally very similar. And here, where they're spread out, as in compounds we find in nature, this shows much greater structural complexity. And so, since structure is tied to function, compounds collected from nature show much greater potential for diversity of pharmaceutical applications. So nature wins. So how do we know that these compounds are actually toxic to herbivores? Well, we know they're not required for the functioning of a cell. But we also directly test toxicity by using this lab rat of a caterpillar. And we incorporate compounds into artificial auger diets and then measure how the insects grow. And mostly, they don't grow. They die. So these compounds, these chemicals, are actually extremely powerful. And they're also pretty clever. And I just want to show you how one of these millions of compounds works. So first of all insects have exoskeletons. It's a hard outer shell. So even caterpillars have a head that's an exoskeleton. It's sort of like a football helmet. And so to grow, they have to molt to get a bigger head capsule to grow into. But plants have evolved a toxin called ecdysone that inhibits molting so that as the caterpillars keep growing, they crush themselves to death inside their own heads. It's one of my favorites. So although we've really only scratched the surface, there really is a staggering diversity of plant toxins. And not only are there an infinite number of compounds, but different compounds can be combined in the same leaf. So this creates a truly infinite number of defense combinations, which is quite a challenge for herbivores. And our work has shown that the most effective weapons plants have are these toxins. But they're not the only ones. And due to time, I can only show you one other defense, the humble hair. A physical defense. So it's not quite as impressive as the universe of chemicals, and hairs don't look very fierce. And in fact, to our touch, they're kind of soft and fuzzy. But imagine you're a tiny caterpillar with a soft tummy. Suddenly these hairs aren't quite so fuzzy. And in fact, they're more like giant meat hooks. So here is a hair, and it has just pierced the caterpillar here, and this white stuff is hemolymph or caterpillar blood. So the humble hair can actually be a very effective physical defense, a little bit like teeth in animals. And plants have taken hairs one step further. Some hairs are tipped with cells containing toxins, kind of like poison darts. So these clear cells here are actually full of toxins. And I say toxins, but in this particular case, this compound was new to science, and the function was actually unknown. And to make matters more confusing, the caterpillars would eat these glandular trichomes like lollipops. I mean, and nothing bad happened to them. They grew just fine in the lab. But in the real world, it's a different matter. Turns out these unknown toxins make the caterpillar poop smell, which attracts predatory wasps that eat the newly hatched caterpillars. I know. So, you know, plants are basically using predators as their bodyguards, you know, and I think most people have a hard time imagining that plants are able to manipulate animals to help them out in ridding themselves of herbivores. You know, pretty clever for an organism that can't think or run away. So that's just a really rapid view of like two of the many ways plants are able to defend themselves. And I hope you get the idea that plants are not helpless vegetables, but in fact are actively defending themselves against herbivores. In fact, you may now be feeling sorry for the herbivores. I mean, how on earth do they find something to eat without getting poisoned, impaled, or ripped apart by predators? It's hard. And it's led to what we call the evolutionary arms race. And so plants are evolving novel defenses, and herbivores are evolving counter-adaptations, and so on and so forth. And this has been going on over the expanses of evolutionary time. So I told you how plants are faring in this battle. How are the herbivores doing? And although they have evolved an impressive array of adaptations to counter the plant defenses, most species of herbivore can only feed on a few species of plant. And here's some data we collected at one site in Peru. We collected thousands of individual herbivores belonging to 175 different species. And of these 175 species, over 140 of them were found only feeding on one to three species of plants. About 20 of the herbivore species could feed on up to 4 to 6 species, and a few made it up to 9, and that was it. So remember, this is a tropical rainforest, and so there are well over 500 species available in the neighborhood, yet any given herbivore can only feed on a very small fraction of the available plants. So from the perspective of a single herbivore, imagine how difficult it would be to find the few species of plants you can feed on in that sea of green. And from the perspective of a single plant, only a few of the thousands of herbivores that are out in the forest are able to eat you. And so we refer to this pattern as a very high degree of specialization. And I'm going to come back to that. So to summarize this section, our research has highlighted that plants have this arsenal of defenses, of which chemical toxins are the most effective and innovative. So the simple take-home message is that because of this arms race, plants are constantly evolving defenses that are more effective and elaborate, and herbivores are constantly evolving counter-adaptations. So what are some of the research questions that Tom and I are focusing on now? I showed you that plants have lots of defenses, but we were interested in better understanding how these defenses evolve. And we've asked whether it's through changes to regulatory genes or structural genes. Do defenses evolve faster than other traits not involved in defense? How frequently are novel compounds arise? And although we spend a lot of time focusing on these questions, I don't have time today to tell you any results. But I did just want to give you a flavor for the kinds of things we're working on. Another big question is, why are there so many species of tropical trees and even more species of tropical insects? You know, where do they come from? How do you get two species evolving from one? And could plant-herbivore interactions, in fact, be promoting rates of speciation? I don't have time to talk about this question either, but it's really important and still unresolved. But I will talk about this question. Why are tropical forests so diverse? In other words, how can so many species live together as neighbors? And this is not a new question. In fact, it's been tantalizing explorers ever since they first set foot in tropical forests over 300 years ago. And in fact, this question is still tantalizing scientists today. And for good reason, because trying to understand what controls diversity is such a fundamental question in ecology. So for example, in a tropical forest, there could be over 650 different tree species in a single hectare, and that's about the size of a city block. And this is more species than in all of the US and Canada combined. So in this picture of a tropical forest, almost every individual tree is a different species. If this picture had been taken in Utah, we'd have two, pinyon and juniper. So it's not surprising then that scientists are still wondering how you can fit orders of magnitude more species in a tropical forest the same size as a city block. And one of the reasons this is so puzzling, and is the focus of so much current research, is that for these many species to coexist, they must have different niches. Otherwise, one species would be the best, and it would win. So traditionally, niches were thought of as abiotic, different ways of dividing up light, water, and nutrients. So for example, some species of plants might be better adapted to sites with a bit more light, or others to a slightly wetter soil. But it's simply impossible to imagine that there could be 650 different habitat niches in a single city block. So Tom and I thought that perhaps plant defenses might be the secret to explaining this really high diversity of tropical rainforests. So we set up many small plots in Panama and Peru to see which species were growing together as neighbors and if this would give us a hint as to how so many species could coexist. And the results are here. Neighboring trees are more different in defenses than you would expect by random. And here's a cartoon explaining this. The box is one of our plots that we measured, and each circle is an individual tree. The colors indicate different defenses, particularly different chemical defenses. So in this plot, each is a different species, is a different color, and therefore has different defenses. So why would this be surprising? Because if you randomly pick trees from the species that grew in the area, you would get some repeats. And in this case, we have several individuals of the red species. So why is this expected distribution different from what we actually observed? Well, as you may have guessed, it has something to do with herbivores. And remember, most herbivores can only feed on a few species. So in this cartoon, the very hungry caterpillar has adaptations to eat only red species. So when there are lots of red species as neighbors, the caterpillar can easily move among them and eat them all. And so if you have the same defenses as your neighbor, the chances of getting eaten are really high. This means no one species can come to dominate. If any species gets too common, it suffers high herbivory. But if you are different than all your neighbors, like this red species, it's more likely that there are no herbivores in the neighborhood who could eat you, and you will do well. So we're arguing then that the really high local diversity is probably thanks to the fact that there are lots of herbivores, that plants have really effective defenses, and that the herbivores are forced to specialize on only a few species of plants, plants for which they have adaptations, counter-adaptations to the defenses. So the herbivores are therefore weeding out common defense types and favoring rare individuals, which would have the effect of promoting diversity. So as I said, scientists have struggled to explain this high tropical diversity, given that plants are all making the living in more or less the same way, needing light, water, and nutrients. However, I showed you that there is really an infinite number of defensive profiles, which translates to an infinite number of niches with respect to herbivores. If you have different chemistry, you will have different herbivores. Thus, herbivores are eliminating neighbors that have similar defenses and enhancing local plant diversity. There are now a few other studies in other tropical systems that are finding these same results, bolstering our hypothesis that it's the plant-herbivore interactions that may be the key mechanism for enforcing high local diversity of tropical rainforests. And this is really rewarding, as it's been one of the really long-standing puzzles in ecology. So now I want to talk a little bit about what's involved in collecting the data I showed you. And we spend a lot of time in the lab characterizing plant toxins. And as you can see, it's a lot of fun. And by characterizing, I mean purifying compounds and identifying their structures. And remember, each species can have dozens to hundreds of compounds in a single leaf, and most of them are not yet known to science. Multiply that by the 300 or so species we're studying, and that's a lot of fun in the lab. So we also need to know who the herbivores are. But this presents a lot of problems, is because most of them are unknown to science. Furthermore, the few that do actually have scientific names are adult moths and butterflies. So these are captured as adults, either at light traps, which attract moths at night, like the picture on the top, or with nets or baits for catching butterflies in the day. And in both cases, there's no way to know what the caterpillars look like. So to deal with the mysteries of caterpillar ID, basically we sequence the DNA from every single specimen we collect. And those that have the same sequence are therefore the same species. So it's really like a barcode, a very expensive barcode. But my favorite part of the research is the field work. And my husband and I used to work, just the two of us, sometimes tenting alone in the forest, and that was the best. However, you do get a lot more work done with assistants. Plus, for them, it's actually a life-changing experience. And we always pair a U.S. student with students from the host country where we're working, and there really is a lovely synergy to the learning. So as romantic as tenting is, the logistics of life take a lot of time. So if possible, we work at field stations, as Sylvia said, without internet, preferably. But this pictured here is the Hilton of field stations, run by the Smithsonian. It has internet, water, electricity, chemistry labs, all right in the forest. However, it's one of a kind. So most field stations are quite primitive and remote, which makes collecting and preserving specimens quite difficult. And there are more field stations in California than in all of the tropical rainforests. So despite housing more biodiversity than anywhere on Earth, rainforests are still really poorly studied. So just to give you a little flavor of what it means to work at a field site, first there's the arriving, And arriving in helicopter is my favorite, but that's only happened once. most often, it's days by dugout, as rivers function as highways in areas without roads. And arriving means arriving with all the equipment you're going to need for 3 months. No running to the store for broken valve or extra solvent. All means all. So here's a view of a site in the Amazon of French Guiana. And as you can see, there's nothing but forest. It's far from humans, and generally the farther from human settlements, the better in terms of finding intact forest. And to my eyes, expanses of untouched rainforest are one of the most beautiful sights on Earth. I hope you agree. And here's the field station, nestled in a tiny little clearing in that ocean of trees. And at this site, there are actually 3 buildings, and they can accommodate up to 10 people, but that actually felt kind of crowded. Here's the dining room where we would cook and eat, and the food is all canned, first of all, because cans keep forever, and also cans are pretty good at keeping out the non-human animals. Here's the dorm. There's a plastic roof that keeps some of the rain out, and the little tents you see inside keep some of the biting insects out. So all the buildings are open on all sides, which means every time it rains, which in a rainforest is quite frequently every day, it blows through and gets everything wet. And this is the lab. And there were many challenges of working in such a primitive space, but one particular challenge for us was trying to keep the leaf samples clean for chemical analyses. And all sorts of creatures lived in the roof, and when they would scuttle about or when the wind would ruffle the plastic, which was most of the time, plastic would, from the deteriorating roof, would fall into our samples. But, you know, despite these inconveniences, you know, you can't really complain about working in a lab like this where you get to see, hear, and smell the rainforest all around you. And this is the clothes washing area, and clothes do get dirty doing field work. This bucket was meant to be for washing, but somebody was soaking a dead monkey skeleton in it, and I was not about to remove it. And what about toilets? You know, with astronauts, I've always wondered how they go to the bathroom in space. Well, to keep up with the astronauts, you know, where did we go to the bathroom? We fertilized the woods. So personally, I find the forest, you know, beautiful, fascinating, and peaceful, as well as a marvelous intellectual challenge. There's really no place I'd rather be. But people always ask, you know, aren't you ever afraid? You know, what scary animals have you seen? So, yes, we have seen jaguars, but it's always an absolutely precious gift. I wish we could see more of them. And yes, there are deadly poisonous snakes, and we have had actually more close calls than I would like, but so far so good. And vampire bats, and despite being so cute, they actually carry rabies, which is deadly if untreated. And one of our assistants was actually bitten, but luckily we got her treatment and she lived. And spiders. This is the largest spider in the world, the Goliath bird-eating spider. And personally, I'm actually not that fond of spiders, even small ones. So when this one crossed my path, you can guess who gave way. And I dreamed about it, and I bet it wasn't dreaming about me. But one of my biggest fears is the small things, the things you can't see, particularly parasitic diseases. And here is my personal list: malaria, leishmaniasis, dengue fever, amoebas, botflies, hepatitis, filarial worms, mango flies, you know, and some other ones. But the scariest was when I nearly lost my husband to malaria in Zaire, which is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. And none of the modern medicines we had brought with us worked. But he was finally saved by quinine, a plant defensive compound. So quinine has become my personal favorite of all the plant compounds. And our biggest fear, another one of our biggest fears anyway, was big, and that's falling trees. And here is our rain tarp and sleeping tent in Brazil. And if this branch had fallen a few hours earlier, well, we wouldn't be here. And actually, trees fall a lot in rainforests. Most of the biologists I know this is what we're afraid of. Okay, so I spent my professional life in tropical rainforests addressing these and other questions, and I am happy to say that we've made substantial contributions to fundamental problems in ecology and evolution. However, my mother could never understand why I insisted on traipsing off to the jungle, and besides, what earthly good was it to know about caterpillars eating leaves? And of course, mothers are always right. You know, what earthly good indeed. You know, the rainforests were being destroyed all around us. We encountered it all the time when we worked all over the world, and it was profoundly depressing. But what could we do about it? You know, all we did was basic science, as my mother liked to point out, science that had no obvious application. So Tom and I had a midlife crisis and decided to try and save rainforests. And one way not to lose rainforests is to use them. In other words, could we find uses that would bring more benefits than destructive alternatives such as logging, mining, or development? So, by chance, we settled on bioprospecting or searching for medicines in nature as a way to use the forest. But first, is nature actually a good place to look for medicines? Surely our sort of modern pharmaceutical and chemical scientists don't need to go grubbing around in the woods looking for compounds. But actually they do. About 40 to 50% of the new pharmaceuticals, and I mean prescription drugs, come from nature. And this is true today and has been true for at least 20 years. So nature does seem to be a very good place still to find medicines. But rainforests are relatively unexplored, and this is despite the fact that our work suggests that there's a chemical universe inside tropical leaves, and this should be a terrific pharmacy. But how do you find the right compounds? As I'm fond of saying, it's a jungle out there. So we thought we'd find the right compounds by using our basic science knowledge about plant chemical defenses and use this to guide collections. And if we found useful medicines, it would not only benefit human health, but hopefully also global health by conserving rainforests. And we picked Panama because we'd worked there. So how does bioprospecting work? Well, traditionally, bioprospectors collect mature leaves, as that's what you see when you go into the forest. But our work has shown that mature leaves are defended by toughness and tannins, two traits that work very well against herbivores, but have utterly no pharmaceutical potential. Instead, our basic science showed that young leaves, because they can't be tough, must rely heavily on chemical defenses. So, for example, we found that they had unique compounds, compounds that were only found in the leaf during that two-week period when they were young and growing, and then not in the mature leaves. I also showed you they have lots of compounds, 50% of their weight. And the compounds were actually more biologically active. In bioassays with diseases, they had tenfold higher hit rates than mature leaves. So our basic research, which we conducted for entirely different purposes, suddenly had an application and something that we had never anticipated at the onset. But to promote conservation, the country needs benefits, and the benefits should be immediate and guaranteed. Yet most of the agreements only include royalties as the benefit, and the possibility of getting royalties is almost zero. So here is a pipeline of how to get a drug to market and get royalties. And as you can see, it's a very long process. The first step is collecting plants in nature. Then you make an extract and test that in bioassays. And if you get a hit, you have to identify which of the many compounds in that milkshake is responsible for the activity. Once those are purified, you can test them in animals for efficacy and toxicity, and then move on to humans, and then if you're really, really lucky, you get a drug to market. But actually, only a few dozen drugs worldwide make it to market every year, so very few people get royalties. Furthermore, only the first step of plant collections is done in the biodiverse country, and then samples are typically shipped to the US and Europe. So all of the money and jobs that are involved in all those other steps happens in the U.S. and Europe, and not in the host country where the plants were collected. So Tom and I asked, why can't we do at least part of this pipeline in Panama? And after a lot of work, we got $15 million in grants for Panamanians to do drug discovery work in Panama with the goals of providing guaranteed and immediate benefits. And we've actually been able to accomplish all these steps, not only creating jobs, but also a much more valuable product than a bag of dried leaves. And remember, no one anywhere gets a drug to market, but just being in the game is success. And so now Panama is in the game. And so Panamanians make collections throughout Panama, and it's a biodiversity hotspot, so it's a very good place to look for drugs. This giant thing is an early GPS unit, not very convenient for lugging around in the rainforest. Leaves are collected, brought back to the lab, and extracted for testing in bioassays. So we set up several bioassays, including the big money makers, cancer and agricultural pests. But we also included diseases which are not big money makers, but do have enormous public health impacts in developing countries. For instance, malaria kills a child every 20 seconds. Leishmaniasis eats your flesh. It's a bit like leprosy, and it's treated with antimony injected daily into your heart. Antimony is a heavy metal. One down from arsenic, two over from lead, if you remember your periodic table from high school. It's not good stuff. And the treatment was invented in 1905. And I had the treatment, and it was unclear who was going to succumb first, me or the leishmania. Chagas disease, or American sleeping sickness, is probably what killed Darwin, and there is no cure. So it's painfully obvious we need better treatments for tropical diseases. So if we get a hit in our bioassays, then we have to find the compound, one of dozens in that extract, that was responsible for the activity. So we also had to establish a bunch of chemistry labs, and we started by buying air conditioners and folding chairs and moved up to HPLCs, NMRs, and other sophisticated equipment that you need to do chemical research. And all of this was an experiment. Everyone was skeptical that we would be able to do first-class research. And so here's some of the team in Panama. So whenever I say we, I really mean them. And so the question was, you know, have we been able to do first-class research? And actually, yes, beyond our wildest dreams. And here's a list of some of the exciting patents we have discovered. And they're promising leads against malaria, leishmaniasis, as well as cancer. And we named the compounds after places in Panama where we discovered them to promote national pride. So for instance, coibamide was discovered on Coiba, and I'm going to come back to Coiba in a minute. So many of these compounds are not only active against the disease target, but they work via a whole new mechanism of action, and that makes them very exciting. So I've kind of glossed over the R&D infrastructure that we were able to create, and also the many research and educational opportunities that were opened up. But those were immensely rewarding in themselves to everyone involved. Furthermore, as Sylvia said, the program has been highlighted by the UN as the model for how to do bioprospecting right. In other words, how to ensure that benefits actually flow back right now to the host country. A second innovation of our program was to link the drug discovery to conservation. And we proposed that by creating jobs that were dependent on intact rainforests, that this would be a much more powerful incentive for preserving forests and much more effective than exporting leaves and hoping, waiting for unlikely royalties. So what specifically have we accomplished with respect to conservation? I'm happy to say we've created more jobs than logging. We've also obtained protection for several threatened areas, including Coiba, where we found coibamide. And this is a false color satellite picture of the island of Coiba in green and part of the mainland in red. Green means the land still is forested. Red means it's deforested. And as you can see, Coiba is still a forested jewel. And actually, the surrounding ocean is also a biodiversity hotspot for marine organisms. So it was a really big coup to get this named a World Heritage Site, which is the highest international protection you can get. And we also engaged members of the urban community. And here's one of our biochemists. And he, like many city dwellers, had no interest in the forest. But the project has really changed his perspective. So now he's one of the most effective voices for conservation in the whole country. And typically, conservation programs tend to focus on empowering the people that live in the forest. So our program is sort of a unique model showing that there are also huge benefits to engaging the urban community. So now in Panama, there's this new and very powerful voice at the policy table, Panamanian scientists involved in bioprospecting, and they're arguing for conservation. And basically, thanks to them, Panama has changed its development goals away from gambling and shopping to bioprospecting and ecotourism, two non-destructive uses of the forest. So by targeting young leaves, we've made discovered successful leads for pharmaceutical drugs. We've created this drug discovery program in Panama with unprecedented opportunities for research and education. And this in turn has had this profound effect on conservation and government policy. So, well, thank you. Actually, even my mother was proud. She sort of had to admit, you know, all that useless research on baby leaves and caterpillars actually wasn't so useless after all. So I just want to summarize briefly and say I hope I gave you a glimpse of that sort of hidden and largely unexplored world of tropical rainforests. And I showed you that the coevolutionary arms race between plants and herbivores, remember the biggest battle on Earth, has driven the evolution of a battery of plant defenses, including a staggering array of toxic chemicals. So plants are not helpless vegetables, but in fact are defending themselves actively and also manipulating animals to help them out and serve as bodyguards. And nowhere is this arms race more intense than in tropical rainforests. So this arms race is playing out over evolutionary time, but Tom and I also thought that plant-herbivore interactions might have an impact in ecological time, specifically explaining the high diversity of rainforests. We argue that it may very well be due to these plant-herbivore interactions, with the herbivores weeding out plant species if they become too common. And as I mentioned, understanding tropical tree diversity has been a very long-standing puzzle, but we are making progress. And finally, our years of basic, boring research on plant defenses had the unanticipated value of being pivotal in designing this bioprospecting program that was not only successful in finding drug leads, returning immediate benefits to the host country, but also in terms of conservation of forests. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Lissy. You've been listening to live radio on KCPW 88.3 and 105.5 FM. So we're going to take some questions for about 15 minutes or so. We have two microphones. If you'll raise your hand and hold your question until you get a microphone so that people out in radio land can hear it as well, Lissy will take some questions.
Yeah, oh. You're on.
Okay. Was the forest thing about the... In the forest, is there any poison ones? If humans touch, they will get poisoned?
The plants, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, the worst thing I've ever touched is poison ivy here in the U.S. There are some. Mostly you don't want to eat them. To the touch, they're not so bad. They will poison you if you eat them. Yes?
Has your team in Panama developed any drugs that have gone on to the market?
No, but almost nobody does, as I said. Also, it's a very long process, maybe 20 years from the beginning, so it's a little early, but those ones I put up there, we're hopeful. Stay tuned. That would be the icing on the cake.
Hi. Me next? Hi.
Hi.
Do you worry about finding a compound that is so successful that it might endanger the plant that it comes from, like the yew and tamoxifen?
Great question. Yes, we worry a great deal about that. And so what we've done to, because obviously that would destroy our whole purpose of doing this. So what we've done is set up very strict legal, I mean, most of what we've done, we've probably spent 3 years writing legal agreements in Spanish, you know. I can barely read them in English. Anyway, we're writing them in Spanish. And one of the, all our collaborations have to be that they, and most companies would actually want to do this, that you synthesize the compound. With Taxol, that was a trouble, but now they are able to do a semi-synthesis. And so that would be the first step. And if that was not possible, then it would have to be grown in plantations on degraded land, which would also be probably a very good cash crop. They are not allowed to go collect it in the woods. And we collect only a few grams. But it's that's a very important concern. Yes.
How old are the rainforests, and are the different rainforests the same age or different ages?
They're different ages. And it's sort of, with plate tectonics, it sort of depends how long they've been sitting on the equator. And Africa is actually not as diverse as the other forests. Southeast Asia is very diverse, like in the size of this room, but it's the same species over and over again. I mean, it's still very diverse. It's a rainforest. And so probably the biggest regional diversity is South America. Yes.
Hi. Who owns the patents? Are they American, or are they Panamanian, or what?
It's whoever discovers it, because we have to go by international patent law. Otherwise, doesn't make any sense. So the person that discovers it is the inventor. And these patents were put through many of them were put through the Smithsonian, which is our umbrella in Panama. But we have, no matter what, if we ever get benefits, you know, we have an agreement such that the majority of the benefits go to conservation in Panama, and the rest is divided up amongst the institutions that are involved in this program, which are the Smithsonian, which is U.S., and the others are all Panamanian institutions. So we spent a lot of time trying to write the legal agreements such that as much benefit as possible could go to the host countries. Yes?
What if you accidentally run out of resources or get poisoned yourself, then what happens?
Yeah. Well, I could always stand to go on a diet, you know. So. No, but that is a problem. As you saw, you invest all this effort to get into a field site. You're going to be there for 3 months. And, you need all your food, and you need every little paper clip, every pencil. We count how many pencils we're going to bring in with us. We're getting better at it. We don't forget things so much anymore. Yeah.
Can you comment on the evolutionary rate of the tropical rainforest, the particularly insect herbivores and the plants, versus how our commercial pesticides and how quickly they become ineffective due to evolution?
Yeah, so most pesticides within 1 or 2 years, already resistance is emerging in the insect population. And so you can imagine basically how, you know, in a real forest, the plants are constantly having to sort of do experiments with evolutionary experiments with new compounds. And one problem that has always bothered us is you have trees that live 100 years, and you have herbivores that live a few weeks. And so the generation time is very different between those two groups. So how can the trees still be around in this arms race? Because herbivores can evolve much more quickly. And one of the questions that I'm sure you didn't really notice that I put up for a millisecond was, are these novel defenses arising more through changes to structural genes, which would mean inventing a whole new compound, which does happen every so often, like nicotine, something like that, or the horrible glucosinolates in broccoli that you may or may not like. Those have only evolved once. So every so often you get a new compound evolving. But what we think the major mode of evolution probably is changes to regulation. So you have all these compounds you could make, and there's a mutation that says, make everything in this direction or make everything in that direction. And so from the perspective of a tree, it's a fairly simple mutation that suddenly gives you an entirely different profile of defenses. You know, you make saponins instead of phenolics. And from the point of view of an herbivore, that's a huge jump and impossible to track in evolutionary time. So this is a very ongoing battle. And our agricultural companies aren't able to keep up, basically. Yes.
All right. I hope this isn't a stupid question. Actually, I'm really hoping it's not. So plants go through a process of photosynthesis by absorbing water in the earth, carbon dioxide in the air, and sunlight. Now, because of this, humans are basically polluting the air, putting more carbon into the air than necessary. Now, you were showing us these charts and everything about how plants are actually evolving and being more efficient than the herbivores that are eating them. Is it possible that humans are actually speeding up the process because of us putting all these carbons into the air and speeding up their evolution rate?
No, I'm sorry. I kind of wish that was true, but no. Having higher levels of carbon dioxide in the air, originally people thought that would make plants grow faster because plants take up carbon dioxide to make sugars. And in short-term experiments, it does. But in long-term experiments, not so much. So that wouldn't speed up evolution. It might, in some cases, speed up growth rate of plants a little bit. But the other flip side of that is that if they have more carbon, more, and they can make more photosynthesis and have sugars, but they're still limited by nutrients, they have sort of extra carbon. So they could store it as sugars, which would not be a good idea, or they could store it as carbon-based defenses such as tannins. And so one of the predictions for global climate change is that leaves are going to become less and less palatable to herbivores because they're going to be building up higher concentrations of tannins. So it's not going to influence evolution, but it will be influencing these ecological relationships, probably in ways that we fully don't understand.
Thank you.
It's not a stupid question. Yes, in the back.
I had a question about the grants and...
Bad news. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, and how did you go about getting them, and was it easy? Or?
Well, we spent probably 10 years writing grant after grant after grant and getting rejected. Because what do we know about drug discovery? And so we were trying to write a drug discovery grant. And we wrote to the Department of Defense, we wrote to the National Institute of Health, you know, foundations. I mean, literally, we wrote dozens and dozens of grants without any success. And then finally, we got a small grant from the National Institute of Health that kind of got us going. And they actually have a very small program that instead of being just a, you know, a human health-oriented granting institution, which is what they usually do, they had this special section for wanting grants that, of course, addressed human health issues like drug discovery, but also had some component that dealt with conservation. And so the first round of these, what the people were doing, they were already established drug discovery people in the U.S., so they went and collected wherever they collected, and then they made a little nature trail or a little guidebook to the palms, and they brought everything back to the U.S. and worked in their labs. And so then we tried our project, and we went to Washington, D.C. for a review of all of them. And we were mortified because people were getting, you know, patents and stuff, and we were still buying folding chairs and air conditioners and figuring out what a bioassay was, you know. And I wouldn't have known a cancer cell if I sat on it. And at the end of that meeting, people were saying, wow, you know, what would these projects have left in the host country if the funding dried up tomorrow? they would have left a, like a nature guide. And so by the end of that, everyone was saying, the Panama model, the Panama model. And so the next request for proposals made that a key part of the program had to be done in the host country. So that was sort of another, of course, it made our competition worse. But it was a success in that obviously we want this to be a general model. But it's very hard getting these grants, and especially getting grants, too, to follow up on some of these leads with tropical diseases. You know, they're just not that well-funded. Yes.
I just want to thank you for all the research that you and your team are doing, and also you talk only of leaves. Are you doing whole plant study with the bark and flowers, or is it just leaves?
Well, we started with leaves because that's what our basic science project was. I won't do things that are more destructive than that, like roots and to some cases bark, just because, you know, I don't want to have too much of a negative impact. But we have actually totally expanded this to microorganisms and to marine organisms. And so within every one of those leaves, there are probably a dozen to 100 different species of fungi, endophytic fungi, living inside the leaves. And those have actually proved, actually one of our leishmaniasis patents is from an endophytic fungi from the leaf. And part of this was because didn't want to fund plants, they wanted to fund microorganisms, so we were like, okay, we can do microorganisms. And we're also working now, because Panama basically has three oceans. It's got the Caribbean and then two oceans in the Pacific, a cold one and a warm one, because the way the peninsulas are. So it's a very, it's a fabulous place, obviously, to do marine bioprospecting. So now we're working a lot with whatever we can get our hands on in Panama. Yes.
I'm a little curious about whether you have an opinion on essential oils and their harvesting. I know most of them don't really come from the rainforest, but do you have an opinion on whether the harvesting respects and honors the environment, or is it doing damage?
Yeah, I don't specifically know in this case, but in many cases, things say, oh, that comes from the rainforest. That does sort of make me cringe, because the rainforest, you know, it's very diverse, so if you're harvesting one thing, you're kind of nailing it, probably. There aren't too many individuals of those species. So I do worry a little bit, unless they have plantations that they haven't cut down the rainforest to do, but I can't address your particular question. But just because something says it comes from the rainforest, I would be suspicious that it's been done correctly.
Are you working on getting other projects for developing the new drugs in other countries, like, as you mentioned, Ecuador?
Hey, I'm exhausted. This has taken, 20 years of our life. Tom and I put about a third of our time into this project. We never have taken a penny from any of these grants. I'm not sure my department always fully appreciated what we were doing. So it is a lot of work, but we do think it could be a model that could be done anywhere. And so we are host people all the time in Panama to try and help them get something going like this somewhere else. But if you would like to start the next one somewhere, I'd be happy to advise. It's a good thing to do.
It seems to me that if you are particularly focusing in on toxins, that the pesticide industry should be very interested in your results and the compounds that you get, rather than pharmaceutical companies who are trying to target a particular disease or other.
No, absolutely. And there is a lot of potential for some of these exactly along those lines. Obviously, pesticides are not high on my personal list. So, I mean, it depends how they're developed, obviously. But no, you're absolutely right. A lot of these clearly evolved to target herbivores, so agricultural pests should be very likely.
Deal with anopheles, mosquitoes, for example, or some of the other agents that cause some of the other nasty diseases that you had listed?
Yeah.
Dengue fever?
No, exactly. And a lot of these are insect vector diseases. And that's a very difficult question, how you balance the human health benefits of eradicating.
Well, I realize that pesticides is an evil word, but still.
No, they can have good uses. And certainly our agricultural system, as we know it, is very much dependent on them. And in fact, okay, just, we did in fact have an agreement with Dow. and they were actually great to work with.
We have time for one more question.
Okay.
In your expert opinion, what can us non-jungle dwellers do to stop some of this deforestation and maybe promote reforestation?
Oh gosh, that's such a great question. And I don't have a great answer. I mean, there's so many ways, and I think just being aware of it, you know, I mean, palm oil is getting a lot of attention now, but that's something a consumer can, you know, can pay attention to. Also, where you buy, you know, furniture and what kind of, you know, where it comes from. And it's often very hard because some of these certification programs are actually not very well developed or monitored. Eating low on the trophic chain. Being a vegetarian, I'm afraid, is probably the biggest thing as an individual you can do. But just being aware of it, and there are many non-governmental organizations around the world. You know, you'd have to do some snooping around on the internet, but find smaller ones that you think are doing something, you know, that appeals to you personally, and see if you can support those too. But that's a dreadful answer. But you know, do as much as you can, because it does. You know, it's those of us that don't live in the rainforest that are having the biggest impact on them.
Thank you, Lissy. That was-